Okay.
I became chairman of the cemetery committee, and when I saw the cemetery the first time, I couldn't even find my grandmother's grave or marker, and so I determined to renovate it. And I have spent the past 5 years hunting heirs and survivors of people buried in our cemetery for the purpose of renovating their monuments or replacing their monuments or acid cleaning some of the monuments, putting new sidewalks in the cemetery. We tore down the old chapel that was dedicated to Benny Neiman, and we still retain the arch. The one facade of the building is still there, serving as an archway. We've cut down some 100 or 150 trees which had been on the cemetery grounds. We've eliminated ivy, and every stone, every marker in the cemetery is now plainly visible and accessible, although the work isn't done yet. We're still doing the job. I don't know how I get the time to do it, but somehow or other, I find the time. I have an excellent secretary who does all this work for me at a really slight recompense. I have to be chairman of the cemetery trust and manage and invest the cemetery funds. I'm also chairman of the capital account fund of the synagogue, and I manage and invest the capital funds of the synagogue. So I have myself quite a few responsibilities, but I enjoy it, and I seem to think that this is where I belong, doing this work.
Certainly appreciate it. There was an article in the Jewish Chronicle of Pittsburgh on August 31st, 1989.
Yes.
About your work in the cemetery.
Yes.
And I thought it was fascinating that the grave of Emanuel Spector, who I heard my father speak of.
Yes, yes.
And Rabbi Ashinsky, who I heard him speak about.
Yes.
And there's a picture of Rabbi Ashinsky's stone. I imagine there are other stories of interest that you've uncovered.
Quite a lot of very interesting stories.
Could you tell us a little about it?
In fact, we have the family, Epstein family, buried in our cemetery. And Epstein, his name was Burford Epstein, who was known as Young Epi. He was a prize fighter in his youth in the city, later developed a series of parking lots called Epi's Parking Lots, if you remember. His sister died in 1987, I believe, and she left her estate in trust for the care, maintenance, and embellishment of the synagogue cemetery, which we are now in the process of administering. Financially, the cemetery is and the synagogue are both in fairly good financial condition. And we have people who contribute, people who are non-members, who come occasionally to celebrate the anniversary of their yard sites or other affairs, and contribute very substantially to the maintenance of the cemetery. The officers of which at the present time are myself as president, Anton Bigman, who is a lawyer, as vice president, Leonard Skirbel is treasurer, and Mike Zivitz was the secretary, just resigned and being replaced by a realtor named Edward Goldston. Together with the board of directors, we seem to manage the plant, which is in excellent physical property. Is in excellent condition and up to date.
Does the shul have a religious school that they have no children?
No. Now, we have no religious school because there are no children who live downtown, unfortunately. And there are adequate schools in the Squirrel Hill and East Liberty area to take care of the religious aspect of Jewish life.
How long do you think it'll take to finalize cleaning all the stones, headstones?
Probably at the end of my life, it still won't be done. They say that there, although I have never counted them, there are 5,000 markers. They say there are 5,000 markers in our cemetery. And as you can see, it takes a lot of whittling to whittle them down to zero.
Are there still burials in the cemetery?
Oh, yes. We have adequate burial facilities. In fact, we just recently sold some burial plots to a family in Slippery Rock, by the way, who come down here to our services. We get a lot of out-of-town people, Orthodox Jews, who come either to our synagogue or to the Shara Torah, or there are others, Orthodox, but that seems to be the two. Our rabbi is, at the present time, is Rabbi Stanley Savage, who was City of Pittsburgh man. And what was I going to say?
Is he a full-time rabbi?
He's a full-time rabbi, lives on the premises in an apartment that's part of the synagogue property.
This is an ongoing community? Do you get new members for this? How do you get new members for your synagogue to keep
Well,
up?
We get new members probably at the same number of members who pass away. We seem to replace them with new members. They voluntarily, we don't solicit any memberships, but people who want to go back to traditional Orthodox Judaism come to us. And of course, people who are strictly Orthodox and belonging to other synagogues. We have one man who belongs to four Orthodox synagogues. But they won't leave the Beth HaMedrash HaGadolah because there's a traditional feeling of camaraderie, so to speak. At least I feel it in the synagogue itself. Everyone is welcome. Everyone is welcome without fee. We have dues, a due structure, but if you can't pay dues, you can still be a member. Or if you pay nominal minimum dues, you're still just as entitled to vote as a full-paid membership.
And did we know how many members there were in this?
We have about 100 dues-paying members right at the present time.
Well, it certainly serves a real purpose in the community.
Yes.
Congratulate you for
we get people from out-of-town people who go to the Hyatt House or the hotels, traveling people who want to go to the synagogue, and of course they come to the downtown shul, so to speak, which is just a half square from the Chatham Towers up Caldwell Street. And we serve a very good purpose. And we have seminars every Friday morning at 7:45. The rabbi discusses in English, of course, the Torah portion for the ensuing week, since the Torah is read on Mondays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. And on Tuesday at noon, there's a seminar conducted by the Kollel, by Rabbi Israel Miller, who, and the sermon, the seminar lasts for an hour, at the end of which time we serve a modest lunch to those who attend. The number of attendees usually runs between 10 and 20.
Is that in English or Hebrew?
In English. Every Tuesday at 12 o'clock. That's the extent of our cultural program, shall I say.
You do very well. Let's go back a bit to your childhood in Washington, PA, and in Monongahela and so forth. Did you run in as a young man, or even in Pittsburgh when you moved here, did you run into many instances of blatant anti-Semitism?
I mentioned briefly that during high school, my high school career, I was my sister, there were never more than 3 to 4 Jewish students in the entire high school at one time. Yes, Monongahela was noted as an anti-Semitic town. At least that's my observation. I was the second highest ranking student in my senior graduating class, and I remember delivering an oration, it was called in those days, or a valedictory at the high school commencement services, and I was not very bright in or knowledgeable in knowing where to go for financial help. I was never even offered the opportunity of participating in the merit scholarship examinations in those days, although I was almost a straight A student. The Jew was somewhat of an oddity in those days. There were probably 10 to 15 Jewish families in the city, most of whom were in business, and there were never a great number of children in the public school system. And when we went to school and took off for a holiday, we were charged with it. There was no such thing as reciprocity, so to speak, in forgiving the Jewish holiday absences. And there were never any overt acts of anti-Semitism in the community, but there were individual acts of anti-Semitism, because it wasn't unusual for Jewish children to be called derogatory names. And that's as far as I know. Whether or not the opportunities were ever offered, Jews were not members of the various civic organizations in those days, even if they had wanted to become members, like the Optimist Club, the Rotary Club, the various other service organizations. There were no Jews who were members of the Masonic lodges in the area, to my knowledge. And it wasn't until my uncle William, my father's brother, moved to Parkersburg, West Virginia, that he became a member of the Masonic Lodge and eventually became a 32nd degree Mason. Other than that, there were, so far as I can recall, there were no overt acts of anti-Semitism in addition to quiet discrimination.
It's more cultural.
Cultural discrimination, yes.
Were they you friendly with other non-Jewish families? Did you have non-Jewish friends? Did your parents have non-Jewish friends, or did you stick together?
My parents had no non-Jewish friends. My father and mother did not belong to any organizations in the city for whatever reason, and most of the Jewish people were socialized together. That as if they were probably 10 or 15 families. And later, during the holidays, they chartered a hall and had services, hired a rabbi or a cantor, and had services on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That was the extent of the religious activity.
So then you had your bar mitzvah training, and that was the extent of your formal Jewish education?
Yes, yes, yes. I had no further Hebrew schooling after I became bar mitzvah.
Excepting an ongoing one, apparently.
I say you studied on your own.
Well, yeah, not too much Hebrew, though, although most of the stuff we're reading is in transliterated Hebrew, as you know. In fact, a very interesting question came up this morning. I asked one of the scholars at the synagogue how it came to be that a minyan consisted of 10 men and you couldn't have services or read the Torah unless you had 10 men. And he tells me that when the Jews were in the desert, they sent out 12 spies to reconnoiter the territory. And one spy from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And when the 12 spies returned, two of the spies reported that Israel was a good land, and the other 12 spies reported that Israel was a bad place to venture into. And somehow or other, that the Hebrew word is Adis, or Adis, which is 10. That became the basis for the cultural tradition that it requires 10 people to have a minyan and daven and read from the Torah.
Sticking a little bit on the same subject of anti-Semitism, when you graduated from law school and started practice as a sole practitioner, did you run into prejudice because of your religion then? How do you find the situation?
I hate to admit this, but in law school, and I've never discussed it at all until this minute, but in law school we had a secretary by the name of Marie V. Lindsay, L-I-N-D-S-A-Y. She was the secretary and principal, so to speak, of the law school, which was then situated on the 10th floor of the Chamber of Commerce building. This was in 1930. The classes were not large. There were 96 students in our class, freshman class, and of the 96 students, about 60 finished the three-year course. And of the 60 who finished the three-year course, 35% passed the bar examinations. In those days, it was very difficult to pass the bar examinations. In fact, I knew a number of my friends, able students, I thought, who took the bar examinations as many as 5 times and could never pass. Today, that was their way of weeding out the so-called unfit to practice law. When I entered law school, the passing average was 65. And if you got a 65 or up, you were satisfied, depending on how much work you put in. I, of course, was working at the same time as I spent in law school, and my studies suffered as a result thereof. In any event, in my second year, the law school average was raised to 70, and I got a 73, which was fairly average because nobody ever got above 80 or above 79 in law school in those days. They were very, very difficult. And then when I finished my third year in law school, my name was not posted to graduate, and I couldn't understand why, except for the fact that Mrs. Lindsay didn't want me to graduate. And I didn't graduate. My average was 69.4. 70 was required. So she said to me, you must take 3 re-examinations, 3 courses in September, and we'll re-evaluate your scores then. So I recall taking 3 courses, studying for 3 months intensively during the summer of the 33, and taking the re-examinations and coming out with a score of, lo and behold, 69.2, where it had previously been 69.4. So I never graduated from law school and hold it against the law school to this day because I refuse to contribute any money to the University of Pittsburgh Law School or the undergraduate school for that matter. And whereupon I had to spend 6 months in a law office under the preceptorship system, took the bar examinations in July. Took the bar examinations in January of 1934. Passed and was admitted to practice on May the 18th, 1934. And the only reason that she could have she could have refused, and she was the bala boss, so to speak. She was, the law school faculty had very little administrative duty other than teach. And the only reason I can ascribe is that she didn't want me to become a lawyer. That's the only overt act of anti-Semitism that I ran into in law school. Other than that, we didn't run into that in the legal profession.
You
don't see it. Because we've had some very able Jewish lawyers in the last, within my scam, within the last 55 years that I've been practicing, and I think that some of the Jewish lawyers command a great deal of respect, quite a bit of respect. One time when I started to practice, in fact, even before I started to practice law, there were some very able lawyers in the city. There was Charlie Sachs of the law firm of Sachs and Kaplan.
That was Lou Kaplan, I believe.
Sir?
That was Lou Kaplan?
Lou Kaplan. There was Saul Shine, who was a very able lawyer, active in communal affairs. And then later it was Frank Kaplan and Abe from the Keysport. I can't recall his name. Abe Simon. Maybe he's related to you.
No.
And so then there, of course, previously there was Judge Statfield, who was an eminent lawyer and later judge. And there was became a county court judge. Name slips me. Became a county court judge. And the legal profession, I think, is pretty much free of anti-Semitism. In fact, way back in the 40s, I was deigned by the chairman of the president of the Bar Association to install an insurance program with the Bar Association. At that time, consisted of about 2,500 members, and I proposed a new plan of coverage, a plan of coverage for members of the bar, which is still functioning today. Of course, today there are about, I guess there must be at least 6,000 lawyers in Allegheny County.
Is there anything else you want to tell us about your early life or family life or middle life? Synagogue, professional?
Well, my family, my mother was an educated woman. She had gone to the gymnasium in Russia, Russian Poland, which is equivalent to college. And she had studied languages, French, and the social sciences, although she never graduated. And she was imbued with Jewish traditional learning, and she believed in education. All of my sisters were educated in one way or another. Most of them became, two of them became teachers. Two of them became teachers, yes.
Here in Pittsburgh?
No, in Washington County. My younger sister became an elocution teacher. My other two sisters just graduated from high school, but she believed in imparting Jewish lore, and she used to tell me stories end after end of Jewish life in Europe, in Eastern Europe. And she would sing songs to us. We were a very closely knit family because in those days there was no television, of course. There was no radio until 1921, 22, when we listened on earphones to the radio from KDKA and built our own sets using a rolled oats box, a circular box, winding the the copper wire around that to create an electrical field to receive the signal. And the social activity was centered around the home in those days. My sisters played the piano. We were probably one of the very few families that had a piano. And the social life centered around joining and greeting people in our home, which was always open for everybody.
Kind of like a warm home.
Yeah, we never had a key to the front door. There was never any key to our front door. The door was always open, unlike today, when people are terrified to leave their houses.
Jane, do you have any questions?
No, is there anything you'd like to do over again? Anything you'd change? Oh, you're pretty proud of your accomplishments.
No, I'm not really proud of whatever little I have accomplished. I think that I was destined to become a lawyer. The only thing I was probably fitted for, if that. In fact, I used to practice speaking when I was in high school, learning to speak from my diaphragm instead of my throat. And it stuck with me because although I had no formal education in training in voice, I just realized that was the only way to develop a decent speaking voice. You spoke from your diaphragm.
Well, your practice takes you into court.
Yes, yes, yes. And even today, I think I have a fairly good command of the English tongue, and I'm articulate, if I must say so myself.
I think we highly agree.
Thank you. As far as my recall is concerned, with respect to doing anything over again, in the circumstances, I don't think I would do anything over. No.
I think you'd be very proud of what you've accomplished.
Well, I thought at one time I should become a poet and devote my life to poetry, but I just never had the drive, I guess, to quit practicing law and try to earn a living writing poetry. Although I've had some things published.
Oh, you've had some things published?
Mm-hmm. In the college magazines and the poetry journals, nothing special. And I submitted some. Well, I have more rejection slips, I think, than anybody else could possibly have gotten, because the poetry is so very bad.
You're too modest.
But I enjoyed it. I still enjoy it. My son thinks I should have been a writer. In fact, when I was in high school, my English teacher was a lady named Miss Owens, one of the two teachers, I think, who influenced my life. Miss Owens in high school, and then Miss Mills in the fourth grade. Were essentially influential in giving me support. Although Miss Owens in high school thought I should study writing, creative writing. And I tried at one time incorporating legal stories into a narrative form, cases, interesting cases, but they were never published. I probably have some of those writings left among my archives, if I could find them.
I hope you do.
Well, and I'm a collector. At one time collected stamps, which I had given up, collected coins, which I gave up, but I still collect UNICEF stamps and flags. In fact, it's the present time UNICEF collection. It consists of 9 quarto volumes of stamps, historical description of the 150 nations of the world, and the flags. It's still ongoing, by the way.
Interesting.
Well, now you have something to do when you retire.
Yeah, read the stuff that I haven't been able to read heretofore.
One final question. Is there any specific technique for cleaning off these stones? Or
any specific what?
Technique you use for cleaning off
these stones? Yes, we wash them with acid. We buy acid crystals, dissolve them in water. The acid eats off the dirt and the grime. When we scrub them down, and they, after 50 or 60 years, they're almost restored to the original color, providing the original granite or marble was of good quality. Sandstone, of course, is not of good quality because it erodes in the wind and weather. Sandstone monuments aren't used anymore. But if it was good quality marble or granite, the original color and scheme comes out.
Mr. Belchin, on behalf of Jean, myself, and the Pittsburgh Section of the National Council of Jewish Women, and hopefully posterity, we thank you very much for your fascinating hour you've given us.
It's been my pleasure to be here. I probably can only have only given you some fraction of the recall, which is probably waning now, but there are hundreds of incidents that come back to you eventually, at some time or other. And I like to think that I have good recall, even though I'm what would usually be called an old man.